Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, long COVID. For the first several months of the pandemic, experts did not acknowledge its existence. Doctors dismissed patients who sought help for lingering symptoms or symptoms that sometimes came and went. Today, clinics have sprung up around the country to support those who continue to suffer the effects of COVID months or even years after initial infection. And the research is beginning to shed light on the disease. We're still struggling to define it, prevent it, and cure it. Catherine Wu is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She's been tracking our evolving understanding of long COVID. She joined me to share what we know about what some are calling the pandemic after the pandemic. Catherine, let's begin by asking you for a definition of long COVID. I'm not at all sure what it means.
It's actually a great question. And if we asked 100 people, they would all probably give you something slightly different. There actually is no consensus definition of long COVID. It is basically having persistent symptoms for a long time after getting infected by this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. And different organizations have different criteria for what counts as long COVID. And often where people differ is, you know, how long do you have to have symptoms and how long do they have to last for it to really count as long COVID. Some people say it has to be several months. Others say, 4 weeks is enough. But certainly both are just persistence. It's a chronic condition.
Persistence. And what are the symptoms?
Another great question. The lists of symptoms can number hundreds of symptoms long, and there is also no universal list of symptoms. But some of the ones that you may commonly hear about, one is brain fog, or more formally referred to as cognitive dysfunction sometimes. But I think one of the most important things to keep in mind here is that it's maybe easy to think about this being a respiratory virus to think, oh, maybe long COVID is just like having the flu for a really, really, really long time. That's definitely not the case at all. This is a virus that can seem to affect pretty much every system in the body. People have gastrointestinal symptoms. People have neurological symptoms. They can have, issues with heart rate, pretty much everything you can think of. And really, I think one important thing to say very close to the top here is that long COVID is in some ways almost a misnomer. We use it as a single term, but really it's more likely to be an umbrella or a category in the same way that we might say, yes, cancer is a phenomenon, but it's actually this incredibly diverse group of different diseases with different causes, different symptoms, different necessary treatments, and different prognoses. Long COVID is actually likely to be subdivided in the future into a whole variety of different ones.
Well, then how do doctors diagnose it?
It is really challenging. You know, it's not like there is a test for long COVID or, you know, a single metric that doctors are able to use, because there isn't even a consensus definition. It really becomes about listening to the patient, asking them, you know, do you still feel sick? Has your life significantly changed since you were infected by this virus? And how long have those symptoms been sort of coming and going? It really is often a very, qualitative assessment, not a yes-no kind of binary.
So a doctor confronted with a patient who continues to have this total variety of symptoms may say, well, maybe you have long COVID. I mean, is it that vague?
Yeah, so I think, probably the best way to say you probably have long COVID is to have a sense that, okay, you know, we have evidence that you were infected by this virus sometime in the quite recent past, you know, within the past few months, either because you took a test at the time that turned positive or, you know, some other very conclusive way to say that you likely had acute COVID and you had symptoms that maybe started within the weeks or months after, and that just kept going and kept going. What makes this incredibly difficult is oftentimes people will start off with the typical respiratory symptoms right after they're infected. You know, they will be congested, they'll be coughing, they will maybe be feverish and feel terrible. Maybe a week later, those symptoms go away, and then a totally different set of symptoms can appear. They will develop brain fog, they will develop tingling all over their body, they will feel achy and exhausted. They will have trouble walking or driving. And it's not the same symptoms that were there before. Again, this is not just having the flu for 6 months. It can be really difficult to connect back. But given how wide-ranging this has been, it seems like a lot of the persistent symptoms that people are developing really can be tied back to this virus in some way.
So it is the virus to begin with. But then somehow in long COVID, other symptoms develop. You mentioned tingling in the fingers, brain fog. Are those usually symptoms of COVID itself, or are they totally different?
It's a great question. So I think one thing to point out here is that, you know, this is definitely not the first virus that can cause these sort of post-acute syndromes. Basically, the virus comes and maybe probably goes away in a lot of cases, but still leaves, you know, lingering damage behind it. Other viruses are known to do this. This can even happen after flu virus infections in some cases, but they are relatively understudied. They haven't been well appreciated. And with this particular virus, we're still learning so much about what it can do to the body while it's there and even after it leaves. And this gets to another really thorny and challenging question. You know, what is the cause of long COVID? What exactly is happening to create these persistent symptoms that go on for months, sometimes years? There are people who have had long COVID since the spring of 2020. And this kind of opens a whole nother can of worms. I think because long COVID is unlikely to be just one thing, there's really unlikely to be just one cause. And right now, researchers are still trying to figure out what are all the different possibilities for how long COVID can unfurl in someone's body. One possibility is that, you know, when I get the infection at first, I get so sick that, you know, maybe I end up in the hospital. There's, you know, intense damage throughout my body, and it just takes an incredibly long time for my lungs to start healing, for my organs to stitch themselves back together. That can really take an enormous toll on the body. It's like, you know, recovering from a battlefield. Another, though, I mean, really, the majority of people who have long COVID were never in the hospital at all. This can come out of a seemingly mild infection. This can come out of an asymptomatic infection that only produces symptoms weeks down the road. And it seems like, you know, maybe in some cases, there's the possibility that the virus actually never does leave the body and sticks around, hides out in some tissues and forces the immune system to maybe keep fighting it, sort of keeps the body in this chronic war. Another possibility, which may actually make up a larger percentage of cases, scientists aren't yet sure, is that, you know, the virus comes and goes, but as it's passing through, it sort of sets off the immune system's alarms, and those alarm bells never stop ringing. It's like if a burglar comes through your apartment and, you know, it triggers the burglar alarm, but it just never stops. And the body is just inappropriately waging war, and there's immense collateral damage that can go on for a very long time after that. It can affect blood vessels, the brain, all sorts of tissues.
Do we have any idea what percentage of people who have had COVID and have been diagnosed and treated with COVID, how many of those, what percentage of those develop long COVID?
The best estimates that have been emerging, they usually clock somewhere between 10% and 20 to 30%. That is an enormous percentage, but I do want to caution here that, again, because we don't have a consensus definition, we don't have a super clean way to diagnose this, and because we don't know every infection that is out there, it's a really difficult percentage to figure out. And because people are, you know, continually accumulating immunity through vaccinations and infections, we don't know if that percentage is going to shift over time or if the percentage might vary depending on which variant is floating about right now.
What about vulnerabilities? Are some people more likely to come down with long COVID because of what's already in existence in their bodies?
It's another great question, and that is actually a field of research that has produced some really interesting data as of late. You know, it's still not totally figured out, but it seems like there are some risk factors. So, you know, even though the majority of long COVID patients, you know, they were originally very healthy, very young, it does seem like if you did end up having a quite severe case of COVID at first, if you ended up in the hospital, there is a rather high likelihood that you will have persistent symptoms afterwards. So getting severe COVID is not great. There are also a lot of women who end up developing long COVID. That seems to be
more women than men.
Yes. And, you know, it's not entirely clear why that is, though, you know, women do have a higher propensity to develop all kinds of autoimmune disorders. So maybe there's a connection there. Immune systems may be more reactive in younger women. And, you know, there's also the possibility that people who already had certain other viruses, like maybe Epstein-Barr virus living in their body, maybe that has a small chance of upping your likelihood of long COVID because this new virus passes through and then that other virus gets reactivated. They end up accidentally synergizing in a strange way. But a lot of these are really just starting to come out. Certainly, you know, if you do have pre-existing conditions, that may sort of put your body in a more fragile state. But nothing is a guarantee in either direction, and I think no one is not at risk.
I heard of a situation the other day of a young middle-aged man, I think in his late 30s, who apparently had COVID with no symptoms, but for years had been using steroids and now is experiencing long COVID in full bloom. Have you ever heard of steroids being involved?
So I have not seen any data on that. It's certainly possible that it exists, but I think there is now data to suggest that people who are immunocompromised, you know, which can sometimes involve steroids or other immunosuppressive drugs, may have a higher likelihood of developing long COVID, which makes sense. Their defenses are lower than others who have, you know, fully functioning immune systems. They're going to be less equipped to fight the virus off, which may give it the opportunity to do more damage.
Why would you imagine that more women are likely to have long COVID than men? What's the thinking there?
Yeah, so, I mean, researchers are not sure, but I think the main possibility goes back to what I was saying earlier about autoimmunity. So women do seem to have kind of more reactive immune systems, and that may have something to do evolutionarily with the sort of pressures on the female body with childbearing and, you know, all the demands that are on women in that sense. But when it comes to getting infected by microbes, that can sort of interact in a very strange way. Maybe in a sense, you know, it's easier to trigger immune systems in that sense. And so when a virus passes through, maybe just there's more reactivity from the immune system and maybe a little bit more collateral damage. But again, because long COVID could have so many likely causes, it'd be really hard to say this is definitely the reason that we're seeing it. You know, and we also don't know the exact degree to which, you know, being a woman makes you more likely to have long COVID. It could also just be a total correlation, not causative at all. Women are also more likely to talk to their healthcare providers and say, hey, I'm not feeling well. Yes. So I don't think this is a total artifact. I definitely don't think that. But, you know, I can't say it's exactly, you know, 40% more likely or anything like that. That's really hard to figure out.
And what about those who have had the vaccine? Are they less likely to experience long COVID?
The news on this front, I think, is sort of B-plus news. Vaccination and, you know, immunity writ large does seem to decrease the likelihood of long COVID, but it is not by an enormous percent based on recent estimates. It certainly is not eliminating the risk. There was actually a huge study that came out this week in Nature Medicine, and the researchers found that a first round of vaccination, so, you know, if you got your first two mRNA doses, for instance, that seems to very approximately reduce the risk of long COVID by about 15%, which is not huge.
Not huge, yeah, but somewhat.
Right.
We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Catherine Wu, staff writer at The Atlantic. In your reporting, I know you've talked with lots of people who've experienced long COVID. Is there a story that perhaps sticks out to you that you could share with our listeners?
You know, I would encourage any listeners and anyone who wants to learn more about long COVID to read some of the firsthand accounts, because anything I say here will certainly not be as powerful as that. And, you know, I think it's really important to listen to the patients themselves, and there are patient advocates. But I'm happy to share a little bit about, you know, what I've learned through my reporting. You know, one woman I spoke to recently, her name is Jessica, and she lives near Milwaukee. You know, she is in her 30s. She has, you know, a few young kids, and, you know, she was a classical flautist before the pandemic. She was infected quite early on in the spring of 2020. And, you know, within weeks, she had developed pain all over her body, strange burning sensations that she described, like the sort of feeling when you walk outside and it's freezing cold, you're not wearing gloves, you come back inside and you run water over your hands and you get that horrible stinging sensation. That happened to her. It started and it never stopped. You know, she would go to bed at night with pain all over her body, pain in her lungs when she inhaled, and she would fall asleep and dream that she was still in more pain. It was just unescapable. She couldn't walk up the stairs in her house without enormous effort for years. But the, you know, the promising thing that I heard is that, you know, she recently was able to take a course of Paxlovid, which is Pfizer's antiviral drug, and one of her symptoms did go away after she took Paxlovid. You know, this has been happening infrequently. We really don't understand the relationship between Paxlovid and long COVID yet, and I don't think it's going to be a cure-all, but I think this really ups the urgency on understanding long COVID, the toll it's taking on people, and the urgency of finding treatments and therapies that can improve these patients' lives. You know, the NIH has been allotted a lot of money to do this, but those studies absolutely need to move faster, because this is a chronic condition, which means a lot of people who develop it now can't expect recovery anytime soon, which means the pool of people impacted is only growing at this point.
How frequently are doctors prescribing this drug?
Paxlovid. So Paxlovid is actually primarily cleared to treat people who were very recently infected. Long COVID is not an indication to give Paxlovid. Paxlovid is keeping people out of the hospital. It's saving lives, but it is primarily designed to be an antiviral taken early to keep people out of the hospital. And it is doing that. A lot of doctors are prescribing this drug, but it is not a long COVID drug because it has not been tested against long COVID. Very few treatments have been rigorously tested against long COVID because it's so difficult to study, so difficult to figure out what types of treatments might even work. But, you know, I realize it's difficult, but that shouldn't be stopping us from trying.
Are there any other drugs that are in use, being used by doctors for long COVID?
I would say, sort of experimentally. There are certainly things that people are trying, but there are to date no, you know, standard universal evidence-backed treatments for long COVID. There are ways that, you know, patients can seek out palliative therapies, things that they are doing in their lives to make themselves feel better. But everyone's experience is different. What works for one person is unlikely to work for another, which is why we really need to get some new and innovative treatments into trials, because right now there was nothing.
I wonder whether alternative healthcare, for example, acupuncture or meditation or some of those alternative therapies have been suggested or brought into use by doctors.
They often are. And, you know, there have been enormous growing long COVID communities where patients have exchanged, you know, anecdotes, suggestions to manage pain, you know, to really take care of themselves. And for some people, you know, things like acupuncture have worked, absolutely. And I, you know, we can never discount anything that makes a long COVID patient feel better. But I think the main thrust here being that this is more palliative, it's not curative, it's probably not addressing the root cause of the issue. And we also don't know enough to prevent long COVID. Vaccines are helping some, but we need more to prevent any infection at all. And so this really is a public health crisis layered on top of another public health crisis.
So how seriously do you believe the medical community is taking long COVID and trying to address the problem with new experimental drugs, with different sorts of therapies? How seriously are they taking it?
I think more seriously than they were a year ago, and much more seriously than they were 2 years ago. But it is probably still not enough. You know, long COVID clinics have appeared all over the country, all over the world by this point, which is wonderful to see. But many of them are booked out for months, including pediatric ones. Kids can get long COVID too. And, you know, one provider I spoke to months ago, this was months ago in early spring, said she was booked out past Memorial Day for her pediatric long COVID clinic. That is heartbreaking to hear, because in the interim, these people are all suffering. And again, the toll is only growing because this is a chronic condition. And I think maybe even more importantly, that this is not just a medical problem. This is a public health problem.
Exactly.
We're going to need policies to reduce its incidence.
Exactly. And how seriously do you think those policymakers are addressing the issue if it seems to be growing, as you say?
I think this is where we probably have the most room for improvement. You know, right now, much of the world has decided that it's time to move on from the pandemic. And to the extent that any preventive measures are still in place, they seem primarily trained on keeping severe disease, hospitalization, and death at a minimum. That's essential. We don't want people hospitalized or dying. But if long COVID is the threat that it is, which it is, that's not going to be enough. Obviously, you don't have to be hospitalized to develop long COVID. And if transmission is allowed to continue unabated, more people are going to pick this up. Right now in this country, for instance, almost no one is masking regularly. There are no recommendations to mask in most of the country. We are, you know, having people vaccinate and boost, which is, again, essential. But vaccines can't completely prevent infection, which means vaccines alone can't be enough to stop long COVID. Until we develop better targeted vaccines and therapies, I think we do need to think about how we can behave in daily life, mask up when transmission rates go up, and really think about the long-term consequences here.
Do you think that more boosters are going to be recommended before long?
Yes. I mean, we did actually just get a couple new booster recommendations for some new age groups, including the 5 to 11-year-olds, which was expected. And, you know, we're also excited that kids under 5 are going to be able to get their first shots very, very soon. But, you know, there is a decent chance that we may all be asked to revaccinate against COVID every fall as we do for the flu. And, you know, that 15% number I quoted earlier, you know, that's the first round of vaccination. Maybe subsequent rounds will continue to iteratively decrease the incidence of long COVID. That's certainly something that a lot of experts are hopeful for, that as we sort of build up this wall of immunity over the course of many years, maybe long COVID will start to fade. But, you know, we don't want to completely bank on that. And because we're making incremental gains now, I think we also need to incrementally keep some other behavioral measures in our life.
If long COVID continues, what do you think the impact is going to be on our society at large?
It's a great question. I think the most succinct answer I can give is disastrous. We've already seen how much it can impact people's lives. There are people who have been unable to return to work, unable to return to school, whose lives have been completely changed by long COVID. This is not everyone with long COVID. I do want to be clear. You know, the range of outcomes is very wide. But, you know, even if it's just 1% of people with long COVID who are experiencing that degree of debilitation, and even if it is only, say, 5% of people who are infected who end up getting long COVID, that is still an enormous number of people that will have a huge impact on the economy, will have a huge impact on how we view and experience disability in this world. That is, you know, the toll of a chronic syndrome. It impacts people for a lifetime. I would hope that we invest better in taking care of the people who have already developed it, make sure that they are, you know, given accommodations, make sure that they are taken care of and prioritized in future care, and that we take more actions to prevent more people from joining them.
Catherine, there's also this new monkey virus that's come along and has shown up in this country, not in great numbers, but can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so monkeypox is a very, 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 very different virus. You know, it does not spread as easily. You really have to be in very close contact with someone. But you know, there are far fewer cases of monkeypox in this country right now than there are of this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. But I think this is something that we need to continue to pay attention to. This is a dangerous virus, but fortunately, we do have vaccines that work against it. The smallpox vaccine is actually something that works against it. The trick is most people alive today have not gotten the smallpox vaccine because we did not need it after smallpox was eradicated, thankfully. This is something that public health officials are continuing to pay attention to. The worry is that it has been, that monkeypox has been spreading somewhat under the radar for some time. But it's good that we're picking up on it now. It's good that we're paying close attention to it. And I think this is just further evidence that, you know, surveillance for pathogens needs to continue, that we really need to be mindful of public health and the threat that new viruses that spill over into human populations from animals can cause.
Catherine, thank you so much for being with us. So informative. Many thanks.
Thank you so much.
That was Catherine Wu. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.